Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Welcome back to The Bulwark Goes to Hollywood. My name is Sonny Bunch. I'm culture editor at The Bulwark. And I'm very pleased to be joined today by Jason Pargin. Rejoined. I've had him on the show before. One of my favorite guests. One of my favorite modern novelists. But to be fair, I don't read a ton of modern fiction because I get most of my fiction through the screen. I get most of my fiction through screens, which is, I'm sure, something you love to hear, novelists out there. But Jason, thank you for being back on the show.
How's it going?
It's great. So we have you back on the show today to talk about the third book in the Zoe Ash series. Zoe is too drunk for this dystopia. And I have lots of questions about this book, including the title. Because one of the things you have mentioned in your afterwards and forewords and interviews about this series is that you don't really consider the place that Zoe lives to be a dystopia. And then here we have in the title of this book, dystopia. So I'm wondering if you think things have changed over the last couple of years or what?
The character Zoe regards it as a dystopia. But that's part of it, because she's in a position where she's actually very wealthy, and you could argue things are better for her than they have ever been, but she definitely does not see it that way. So that is ironic, because the idea that, like, I'm in no condition to deal with this civilization you have created, that is something that she would say.
But I feel like there's a but here. No, but all right, so we're going to talk about the book in a minute, because I'm super interested in the world that you have built in here, and the kind of funhouse mirror aspect of it to our own times. But before we talk about that, the thing I really want to discuss with you is I very rarely have actual, like, genuine celebrities on this podcast. But today I have one of the leading lights of book talk, Mr. Jason Pargin, which my understanding is the only way to sell books now to anyone, the kids, the adults, whatever, is to become a big viral star on TikTok, and not even necessarily talking about your books, because I very rarely see clips of you talking about your books. It's about everything else. Tell the folks about your adventures with TikTok and how that has kind of changed how you look at the world of novel writing and novel marketing, more importantly.
Well, I feel like we're in an era when that's how everything is being sold, is being able to tie it to some kind of an influencer. Like, I can't imagine anything more dystopian than me coming on here and saying, hey, you all need to become influencers. It's your only hope for succeeding in this world. But there is no question that in a world that is flooded with products and media and everything else, we gravitate toward personalities as a way to cut through the noise. So, you know, it's if it seems like a lot of the people trying to sell you things on social media and elsewhere are like self-help gurus saying, don't buy this product because it's good, buy this product because this is the candy bar that Mr. Beast endorses. And I'm not happy about that. I never wanted to try to become famous. I wrote anonymously for the first several years of my life because I'm a private person and wanted the work. I wanted the work to get famous, but not me. I didn't dream of, like, you know, going to the grocery store and somebody comes and asks me for an autograph. That is not what I want to happen when I'm shopping for groceries. But as in the time that I've been around, just because of the way the market has changed, yeah, you yourself have to be able to promote books, and you have to have some kind of a personality attached to it, unless you're already either a super famous writer who has an established, you know, audience of millions and millions of people, and just your name on the cover does the marketing, or if you're a very fancy author and have won lots of awards and the publisher is heavily pushing you and all of the literary publications are running articles about your book and really pushing it as this is the important book that everyone should be reading this year. But if you're not that, if you're just a guy trying to sell a book or frankly anything, the way you have to do it is by having some kind of a platform where you can reliably reach people, and the platform you have cannot simply be a series of ads for your thing. So you wind up selling yourself as a fascinating personality who you want, you know, people want to be connected to. And then, oh, by the way, I also write books. But it's like in a world of infinite books where even AI can now crank out a novel in 10 seconds, what cuts through is like, okay, I'm going to let you get to know the human being connected to this book. It's the exact same thing as why when you try to look up a recipe for cornbread online, the first three paragraphs are the writer talking about their childhood. That's because there are infinite recipes that only this one came from this particular, they're trying to connect it to our personality. Cause it's like, it's not, you know, the information, the entertainment is a commodity, but there's only one of me. And that is a very weird place for somebody like me to be in with my personality, where again, I didn't like to show my face. I didn't show my face on camera until like, Jesus, 2013 or something. Like I did not want my face out there, but here we are.
Well, let's talk about this kind of evolution of marketing, for lack of a better word, because we talked about this a little bit the last time you were on the show. You know, you had an audience at Cracked. That helped, I seem to remember you saying that, you know, you would put out, something on Cracked and that would drive, you know, 100,000 people, whatever, to the site, 200,000, 300, whatever, very large number. But it was all kind of tied to that. And then that went away. That essentially goes away, which then creates a marketing problem. And I find the whole thing fascinating because we live in dystopian adjacent times, in the sense that everything is not quite what we want, but we have everything we need. And I this is a perfect example of it. You have a great platform here. You have created this little mini empire of short videos and kind of weird, semi-viral things that people find interesting and like to share, but it's not really what you wanted, or at least it's not what you thought you wanted.
Right, but I think this is true for anybody making any kind of art, because you ask a filmmaker, like, what percentage of your time is spent actually shooting a movie and making creative decisions and making the film versus what percentage of your time is spent in meetings or spent dealing with budget issues or doing logistical stuff, like working out permits for some location, like stuff that's the boring tedium. And then all of the politics of trying to, you know, jockeying with the studio for budget, how much budget. And then if you do get a star in your film, dealing with their agent and their people and how much changes they want to make, like the pure art part of the job of making the art is a tiny sliver of it. And then all the rest of it is all of this business stuff on the side. And I think it's most jobs are like that. The central task is only one section of it. And then there's a lot of side stuff that is. So for me, that's just the reality of the job. If I didn't want to be an author full time, I would, you know, I could go get another job. But this is the job. And the job is like 15 to 20% of the time is spent writing books or thinking up ideas for books and being creative. And the other 80 to 85% is promotion.
Yeah.
And that's just because we live in an era of abundance of media. You know, when I grew up, again, I was born in 1975. So in our house for most of my childhood, we had three channels on the TV, three broadcast channels. We did not have cable until I was a teenager. We did not have a VCR. You know, until that technology didn't exist for us until, you know, the late 80s. So I could go to the grocery store and they had a rack of paperbacks. We did not have a bookstore. So, you know, we were in a small town So you had a rack of paperbacks, you had a rack of comic books. I wasn't that interested in those. You had the magazines and you had the TV with nothing on. You had nothing on demand. You know, if you had music, you would buy very expensive cassette tapes, but you know, and we couldn't afford tons and tons of that stuff. So my choices in the era when Stephen King was getting big, like when he came out with a novel, that was my only option for entertainment for that week. Like I bought it and I was going to read it, and nothing else was clamoring for my attention. Well, now we live in an era when infinite books are available. Essentially, infinite books are available for free if you know where to get them, but also infinite video games, live streams, Twitch streams, YouTube, TikTok, social media. If you're trying to slice through an era of abundance, you've got to try to make yourself stand out. And the challenge is just very different than it would have been, you know, 30 years ago. But that's because we have advanced and there's such an abundance of media available to people that they have so many other options. So I can't complain about that. It's just the reality is to cut through the noise, you have to be able to connect with people somehow other than saying, hey, buy my book, because they have no reason to buy your book. Mm-hmm. So it's cutting through the noise to say, hey, look at me, the human being, and how interesting I am. And then you reach millions of people that way. And then you say, hey, of you, those of you who are readers, I write books. Those of you who are readers of this particular genre, I write books in this genre. And then some smaller segment of those people will actually fork over the money to buy the books. And that's how it works. It's just a funnel. You're funneling people into your books.
Yes.
And it is very exhausting.
Well, let's run through what your average day looks like, right? So do you wake up, do you have ideas for here's the short film I'm going to make today? Because essentially that's what you're doing almost every, I have to apologize. I'm actually not on TikTok. I see your clips on Twitter, which is where I spend way too much of my time. It feels like there's a new one every day. Feels like there's a new little 30-second thing every day.
Yeah, I post 3 to 4 videos a day.
Okay.
And TikTok, because of its algorithm, will kill all but one of them, or maybe all of them. And that's dealing with any social media algorithm. If you're not on TikTok, it doesn't matter who you follow. It has a feed. It's like the way Twitter works now, the terrible way that Twitter works now, where it feeds you a bunch of strangers' posts. So it doesn't matter. Like I have about 330,000 followers now. I joined a year ago when I was promoting last year's book. But I can post a video that may only get seen by 600 people. TikTok may just decide to spike it. You can spend 2 hours filming one and then TikTok decide, nah, we don't like that one. So it's a kind of a shotgun effect thing. I have like this big giant list of ideas and I'm just looking for stuff day to day. And then you post and you post until one hits and you've done your work for the day. But TikTok effectively became my day job last year. Once I realized, because for context, I had sold books on Facebook prior to this. I had sold books on Twitter. Facebook is mostly a ghost town. Instagram, I'm on there. They've tried very hard to push video. So if you're still on there, you need to be doing video instead of photos, which was not what Instagram was before. And then Twitter engagement's just fallen through the floor because of the way Musk has changed it. So I joined TikTok because I had to and was not happy about it. I'm not a video person. I had to train myself in how to be on video and what to do with my face and what people seem to want out of video, all of that. I had to learn it. I was not a YouTuber. I was never a video person. But that became my day job because it's like I saw how many people it was reaching. And it's a stupid number of people. I think I total my videos have streamed something like 350 million times over the last year. In the past 60 days, past 2 months, it says I've reached 34 million unique users. There's no other platform that even can come close to touching that. So that basically, at that point, I was basically full-time TikTok person, author on the side, even though in theory, writing books is how I pay the mortgage and how that's what I do for a living. But if you can't reach people to let them know the book exists, then it doesn't matter how good the book is. It just doesn't. Yeah. The publisher can do their job. They'll get the chance to stock it. It'll be on the shelves of Barnes & Noble. They'll probably have it up front in the new release section. It doesn't matter. Without promotion, that will sell a couple hundred copies. People just stumbling across it. It's like, oh, this looks interesting. But if you're trying to sell tens of thousands of copies enough to like do it as a full-time job, this is what it takes. And what I'm doing is like the bare minimum. Ideally, I would be spending twice as much time promoting, but the problem is that I can't hire it out. Because if somebody asks, well, isn't it the publisher's job to promote the book? It's like, well, the publisher can't run my TikTok account. The publisher can't do this interview. Like, it has to be me. It has to be my voice and my face. So what do you want the publisher to do? To hire a lookalike? To go an actor to pretend to be me? It's like, no, it's got to be me. It's just, that's the mechanics. I'm not complaining. That's how it works. It has to be me talking about it. So this is what I think a lot of young authors don't understand. And a lot of them are not prepared to do, which is very reasonable, because I don't think that like Herman Melville had to do this. He sold 3,000 copies of Moby Dick while he was alive.
Right. Right.
It didn't get discovered till after he was dead. So this is what I tell myself, that my books will sell tens of millions of copies in the year, like 2083 after they will all be discovered after I'm gone.
I'm fascinated by the TikTok thing, and I'm fascinated by the video thing for reasons we were talking about just before the show started, which is that I am very explicitly not a video person. In fact, I am recording video on this podcast for the first time, in part because we were just talking about it and how you have to have video to promote things now. How has the game of book promotion changed just in the last 2 or 3 years in terms of what audiences are looking for and what publishers are looking for and what social media platforms are looking for?
Well, this is what is so hard for a lot of people to understand, is that a lot of it is just a change in the technology. Like when I came about, started writing, it was in the late 90s and the internet was basically invented. I got an AOL account. Back then, the internet was basically text only. Like even a photo on your page would drag down the load times back then. Yep. So back then, it's like, it's all, because it's all text only, you know, and I started giving away my book for free. The book that kind of made my career, John Dies at the End, that was written just on a website, on a blog, before they had the word for blog. Back when the internet was text only, and that's all people wanted. It was a bunch of nerds out to read interesting stuff. So then as time went on, stuff becomes more photo-based, but then they didn't invent social media until the late 2000s, and then smartphones didn't become ubiquitous until like 2010. That totally changed the game, because now the nature of what people want to read and ingest on a phone when they were new was photos. That's why Instagram suddenly blew up. So it's like it went from, are you interesting in text, to are you interesting in a photograph? Like, is your life aesthetic? Do you have a beautiful book collection? Do you have a beautiful library that you can take photos of yourself sitting in like a leather chair with your old-fashioned typewriter? And then what happened over the last several years is that smartphones, data plans, everything that allows for streaming video so that a site like TikTok can exist. Because keep in mind, the fact that you can record a video, instantly upload it, instantly have it live, and then turn around and in your car on your data plan, scroll 100 short clips, that technology is very, very recent. But once it was invented, that was how people wanted their content. So from the creator's point of view, it goes from being good at writing to being presentable in a photograph, to having a voice and a face and a presence on video that is compelling. Because again, you need to be able to reach people. You can't reach people unless they follow you and you have a following on a platform. They won't follow you on a platform unless they enjoy watching you now in the video era, watching you talk and say and do things on camera. So I have nothing to complain about because, for example, for women authors, needing to be young and attractive becomes a premium. Because you can go on BookTok, and I follow every woman author I can. I try to support them all. But I do not get elderly women authors. They're on there, their algorithm doesn't feed them to me mm-hmm. because they want a pretty face. And that is not how it should work for an author. If you're a movie star, yeah, I get it. You've got to be hot. But I have the least to complain about because I'm able to get a following. There is such a bias toward being young, thin, and attractive for women authors that I feel like this is a huge loss. If you're a woman starting out, if you don't happen to fit the exact conventionally attractive profile they want, your climb up the hill has to be 100 times harder because TikTok for women is so geared towards the aesthetic and are you pretty? Whereas, you know, the male authors I follow, they just look like us. They're just dudes and they're old guys. And like I follow 70-year-old guys and you can look like George R. R. Martin if you're a guy. And it's like, no, that's what a male author should look like. So I don't have room to complain because I've been very successful, but it is very weird. It's a funhouse mirror version of how things should be because it's like, it's not about your words. It's not about your ability to craft a story or to choose your phrasing or to bring out ideas. It's that plus, are you pleasant to look at and listen to?
Has what you have noticed here influenced the Zoe Ash books and story? Because I feel like some of this comes through, particularly in the most recent novel. Let's shift to talking about the books. Why don't you give people the elevator pitch on the Zoe Ash series, just so they can so they understand what we are talking about here in the broadest sense.
It takes place in a near future where it's not so far in the future that cars are flying or that there are sentient robots, but it is a future where, for example, they have social media where everyone just wears a live streaming camera pinned to their bodies because cameras are tiny and they can run all day. So everyone is streaming their life all the time. So they have a social network it's called Blink, but it's basically a god's eye view of the world because you can hop to any camera feed, any car dash camera, any security camera, any body camera, any drone camera, any spot in the world that you want to look at, you can go look at it. So if there's a live event that breaks out, if there's a mass shooting in Central Park, you can hop to the feed of any victim, of any bystander, of the shooter, and you basically have a god's eye view of the world. So part of what these books are about is, how does this change how society behaves when everybody knows they're on camera all the time? Basically, the moment they walk out their front door, the assumption is you are being streamed. Whether you have your own camera or not, you're in view of somebody else's. So the protagonist is a young woman who was living with her mother in a trailer park, and she finds out that she basically has inherited her estranged father's estate, and her estranged father was a crime lord. So she has to go off and basically winds up through a series of strange and frankly implausible events, has to take over his crime family, and she's this 23-year-old woman from a trailer park, has no idea how to do any of this. And then it takes place in a city that is what libertarians call a charter city, where they find some vacant spot of land and just build a brand new city. And in the fictional world of these novels, in southwestern Utah, somebody has built a sprawling Dubai-type city that's this lawless playground of very, very wealthy people, and everyone is kind of crazy. So she has to go live there in this place that is this sprawling metropolis where there's all of these new technologies, but also she is now living in a world where it's so dense with cameras that she has become a public figure, and she also is very wealthy. So the idea of having to live life in public, it's that amped up times 1,000, which is why I think, for me, that's what good science fiction should do. It's not, you're not trying to predict the future. It's like, imagine if these current trends were amped up to 11, to absurd levels.
And so this brings me to, again, back to my question about video and the treatment of women authors on TikTok, et cetera. I feel like there's just discussing it with you right now, it feels like that has entered its way into your books or into this most recent book, at least in terms of how Zoe feels about herself and how the rest of the city feels about Zoe. Or am I misreading here?
Well, they've always been about that. It's just the technology advances quicker than I can write it. The first Zoe book came out in 2015. So for example, that came out before the Ring doorbells got popular. So the concept of having a social network where it's just kind of ubiquitous neighborhood view of things, whereas now those doorbells are networked. And if if there's a crime committed on somebody's front lawn, you can hop from doorbell to doorbell and see exactly where they ran, who they were, and what car they parked. And then somebody will have their Tesla parked nearby and it captured it on its camera. Like, even in the time these books have been around, the ubiquity of cameras has kind of become even more than what it was when I started writing them. So you're kind of seeing how that affects things already. But what the books are about is, we kind of think of celebrities as all being crazy. And part of that is because they basically have to play a character 24 hours a day. If you're Taylor Swift, you're playing one version of yourself on stage, but also if you're just out at a restaurant, you're still playing Taylor Swift pop star. You don't just get to kick back. There's a public persona. And I think we've always regarded this as an unhealthy thing to have to do, because you can't be your genuine self. People have expectations of you and they project things onto you. So imagine a world where everyone has to be like that. It's taken a phenomenon we already see where, you can go find, there are teenage girls that have 2,000 followers on Instagram, not because they're influencers, but because that's how it's has to be. So the idea that you can be 16 years old and you're taking a picture of your lunch and your lunch has to be interesting to 2,000 strangers, that's already making them do the thing that celebrities have to do that kind of makes them emotionally unhealthy people, where you have to craft a version of your life for public consumption and you're now not acting on your own needs or desires. You're now trying to fit yourself into a character archetype for the public. So the whole concept of the Zoe books is like, what happens when the whole world is doing that? What happens when the criminals are doing that? What happens when, the politicians already do it, but what happens when everybody you run into, every conversation you have out on the street, it's assumed that it's being recorded and will be analyzed and scrutinized later. When do you get to be your genuine self? And it, to what degree is like fame? I think John Updike has a quote that fame is a mask that eats the face. Like, eventually it's just the mask, right?
Yeah.
So that's what it's diving into that. And in the latest book, for example, they're having an election, but it's an election in this extremely stupid era of when people are having to be even more performative than they are now.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
Let's talk about the political aspect here, because I do think it's pretty interesting and does feel it feels ripped from the headlines, shall we say? But I feel like this is a constant question with your books. I remember reading in the afterwards of the previous two, was this character based on Donald Trump? Was this guy based on? It does feel like there is a more explicit connection to the villain in this book I feel fine saying that is a Donald Trump-like figure.
I tried very hard to not make it a Donald Trump-like figure because I started these books because the Zoe's father, who passes away and leaves her everything, he is a casino and real estate magnate. But he was not, the model for him wasn't Donald Trump. It was Bugsy Siegel, the guy who founded Las Vegas and was famously very paranoid and then ultimately wound up getting killed by rivals. And it was like, well, what if there was a futuristic version of that guy who had all of his crazy over-the-top, where he's basically using the power of his personality to build a new city, like to draw investors and to just, because part of being a real estate guy is being larger than life. And they're all kind of gangster and their tone, and they're all very brash. And like, that's just, it's a certain personality type that does that work. So I came up with the ideas for these books before Trump came onto the scene, back when he was just the host of The Apprentice. Mm-hmm. Like before he became president, before he started running, I had, and so now that people are going back and reading these books, is like, oh, this is a Trump archetype. I personally kind of hate when books do that. Or in movies do it and it's clear, it's like the exact guy from real life. And it's like, oh, this is David Crump, the evil racist. So here in these books, it is political. They're in the middle of election, but their two parties are not Republicans and Democrats. They have two very distinct, and the idea was that in the future, just as you would not recognize the two parties from, say, 1960, in the future that you, the two parties trying to win election in this crazy lawless city, don't perfectly align with any party, to the point where you've got one candidate who's kind of a hands-off, laissez-faire libertarian, but who also has an extensive criminal record, and the other candidate is like a eugenicist, and we need to purge society of the impure races. There's no strict Republican or Democrat there. It's just she's having to choose between one, a corrupt candidate and a candidate that she thinks will lead to just a mass purging of society and mass grave. So it's like, well, I'm going with the corrupt candidate every day because we can work with that. But I think this guy wants mass graves. So it is, it's not hero versus villain, or there's one pure party and one evil party. It's the series of bad choices she has to make. And that's kind of the theme of these books. This is a woman who becomes very wealthy and very powerful, but still doesn't feel like she is at the wheel of society. This is someone who grew up being totally cut out of capitalism. She had no role in it. She had no property. She had no promising career or wealth to her name. And then suddenly she inherits all of this property and all of this money and thinks, okay, now that I'm near up here at the top, I can fix the world. And instantly finds out it doesn't work that way. The entrenched parts of the system are far more entrenched than you think. And it's only when she got to a position of power that she realized that.
One of the things I really enjoy about this book is Zoe's team. You know, she has a team of guys who worked with her dad. One of them is a psyops guy named Will Blackwater, which is his last name is a kind of a running joke in the first book. And then and other people on the team. But Will is the most interesting to me because he is the guy who both works within the system that Zoe's father helped build and everybody around Zoe's father helped build. But is also working with her to change the system and kind of temper her expectations on how much the system can be changed, or the speed with which it can be changed. Maybe I should say it that way. I guess what I'm trying to say is here, I like the kind of realistic expectations that the book brings to how do we improve society without first destroying it entirely and starting over from rubble?
Yeah, and this is very mild spoilers for the first book, but basically what you find out is that her gangster father had left everything to Zoe because he was trying to go straight and that it instantly got him killed. And he kind of had this very unrealistic idea that if I put it everything in the hands of somebody from the outside of the system, that could maybe be finally be the change of, because he had only met Zoe a couple of times. It was an exotic dancer he had knocked up, and he did not pay child support, anything, totally disconnected. But in the couple of times he had ran into her, she was like so stubborn toward him and in refusing his money and refusing to have anything to do with him, that he was impressed. He's like, he had this idea in his head. It's like, she's got the toughness I have in me, only she's not been corrupted by the system. So you get the sense that him leaving everything to her was like his last chance to kind of absolve himself, because he helped start this new city and had this naive libertarian idea of, if enough wealth accumulates here, then everything will be fine. Like, we don't need the government. We don't need all the regulations. If you just leave people be, give them enough opportunity, give them enough jobs and property and money, everything will work itself out. And then, of course, it quickly, organized crime swept in, as tends to happen. Same things with the early days of Vegas. Like, you had all of these people, in the absence of strict regulation, you had all these people swoop in and impose their own regulation in the form of, you know, pay me protection money or else I'm going to burn down your casino. So that's kind of the whole thing, is that he had an idea of her that if I just, it's the same thing. It's like, she's a blank slate, which is the name of the city, is Tabula Rasa. And that's the running reference. It's like, I think if we just start over and give her everything, then everything will be fine. And again, the people around her have to explain to her, you can want to change the system if you want. You can want your employees to be treated better than they were under your father. You can want all of these things, but let me explain to you exactly what's going to happen, because you're not the first person to try to change the system, and you won't be the last. So that's the thing, is that it's so much of fiction is about like a wish fulfillment or a power fantasy. And it's like, if I finally had the power, this is what I would do. And here is her learning lesson after lesson and having to make these difficult decisions, which I think is, again, it's what the science fiction I like. That's what it's about. That's why I liked about the old Star Trek. And it's always about these moral quandaries, when it's like, we have an Earth, you know, system that's basically a utopia. We have a spaceship that can do anything. That time and time again, we're faced with these difficult decisions, like, oh, it's not so simple. You can't just interfere with this culture to do this. You've got the prime directive for a reason. And that's the thing, is that it is her running up against the reality of having power over and over.
Yeah. I want to talk about reality for a minute, because we've talked a little bit about the kind of panopticon nature of this society that she lives in. There are cameras everywhere. And in theory, if cameras are everywhere, you would know instantly what is happening, what the truth is, what is real. And that is not necessarily the case. I just want to read a passage from the book. This is a character who is talking to Zoe right now. Quote, "Have you ever wondered what would happen to a society if it became totally impossible to discern fact from fiction?" End quote. After only brief consideration, Zoe said, quote, "Actually, I think we're living in it right now." End quote. This is the other character again. "I mean, truly unable to the point where evidence could be falsified so thoroughly that no human sense could detect a forgery, where lies could be created that are identical to the truth down to the molecule, to the point that all of our forensics and experts would be helpless to determine what is real and what is false. What would people cling to when searching for truths?" End quote. And we are not quite to that point yet. We are not there precisely. But it does feel like we are heading towards that moment in a train that is speeding and full of zombies, and we're out of control and we can't stop it. And we are headed there. What is the answer there? Because I feel like there's. Let me phrase it this way. I feel like you're a little more platform agnostic than I am in terms of how to reach people. And what I fear with TikTok and, you know, some of the other social media platforms combined with the rise of generative AI, et cetera, is that we are getting to a very a place very quickly where truth and fiction are essentially interchangeable. And we have arrived at the choose your own adventure future that should be terrifying to all of us who worry about that sort of thing.
Well, and these books are not trying to tell you, okay, here's what we need to do to fix all of this. It is, and also it's not trying to predict the future. There could be a backlash to this among young people. They could decide they don't want to live their lives this way. They could reject the cameras. This is about what if the incentives keep pushing us the same direction, but you know, a lot of times they don't. There may get to be a point where the way to be a unique and attractive person is to not have a presence, where it makes people think you're mysterious and cool, where this is the version of being the aloof cool guy is by not being on every video platform and not being available, and so they want to seek you out in real life. Maybe that would be the future. But it is worth exploring, because the whole point is that the technology advances much more quickly than the culture can adjust. You know, humans are adaptable. That's why we dominate the planet. That's the one thing that's special about us, is we can adapt to anything. But if change happens too fast, you don't have time to create societal norms around how do you, you know, like right now, people clearly don't have a sense of how to filter true information from false. I think they had it at a time, but it was always imperfect, because they, for instance, believe that everything they're preacher told them was true, you know, or they believed, they were told as young people, believe what the old people are telling you, that age means they're reliable. But there were cultural norms around trying to learn what works, what is safe to do, what is not. And in the mass media era, it has come on so fast, because again, just in my lifetime, the availability of media has exploded a billion times over. It's not just that there's 10 times as much media available, there's infinitely more media available to me now than there was when I was a kid. There's nothing in the human brain and in human culture set up to filter through all of that. And we don't really, like, parents will try to limit their kids' screen time, but okay. Are you limiting, like, are you setting strict rules for what they watch, how they think about what they watch, how to filter through what they're watching, what they hear, to try to find truth? And that's something that, like, are they teaching that in school? How to critically think about claims? If you watch a TikTok where somebody's saying that there's some new health fad, that seed oils are what's killing us, or you have to cut this out of your diet, are we teaching them how to stop and double check that, how to go find an original source? Because that's a skill that now you have to have. Whereas before, that, you know, you could live your life without, you know, it's trying to sift through that much noise wasn't as much an issue. And I think we just haven't had time to adjust. And even if you try to adjust to what we have now and say, we're going to teach this next generation of kids how to live in a world of TikTok and streamer personalities and people trying to turn themselves into a brand to try to sell you things. By the time you've taught those kids, the media landscape will have changed again. But right now you've got some parent looking at their credit card and trying to figure out why their kid somehow managed to send $300 to a streamer. It's like, why did you send $300 to this famous video game streamer? It's like, well, he reads the chats on the screen. And if you pay him, if you donate $300, he'll say your name in the stream. It's like, but what did you get for that? It's like, well, he said my name on the stream. And that's how these people get to be millionaires. Like, it's kids sending them their money. Like, that's a behavior that I don't know that a lot of parents even know to warn their kids against, because they didn't know that was a thing until they saw the money gone.
I am also too drunk for our dystopia. I feel like it is, I have two kids myself, and I look at this world and I think to myself, this is, you know, it's good. There's a lot of things that are good here, but not a lot of things that are not great too. I want to I want to bring this back just very, very briefly to the question about selling books. So you got on TikTok about a year ago.
Yeah, it was last August.
Which was after, I guess, right before the release of the most recent John Dies at the End book.
Yeah, it came out in October. I joined in August as like a last minute, oh my God, I've got to figure out this TikTok thing.
Let me ask you, and maybe you don't know the answer to this. Maybe we don't have any good data or sales figures yet, but have you noticed a tick up in pre-sales? What is the actual measurable effect of this for you in the way that matters to you, which is selling books?
It saved my career. Period. It saved my author career. I do not think I would have been able to persist to get another book deal, because I'm on a book deal. I signed a 3 book deal. The one that's coming out is the second. The third is coming out, or the one that's coming out first. The one that is coming out next year would be the second. I don't know that I would have sold enough books to get another deal without TikTok. It changed everything. It totally turned everything around. Like the pre-sales, this is book 3 in a series. The pre-sales are much, much higher than book 2, which is not a thing that occurs. Like usually you mm-hmm. lose readers in between books because people just don't know about it. It's made all the difference in the world, because my other methods of reaching people, again, Facebook is a ghost town, TikTok or Twitter rather, X is a nightmare of It's a nightmare. It's a dystopian nightmare. But engagement is down there because people are too busy yelling at each other. So there just weren't that many outlets left. This is the nature of trying to sell things on social media, is that entire landscapes vaporize virtually overnight. And you have to rebuild. I mean, think about how many, like back when there were Vine superstars, remember Vine?
Yeah.
There's some of those names. I don't remember where they wound up, and I bet I could go find them on TikTok. They're probably out there, but you know, Vine just disappeared overnight. One day it was there and the hottest thing, then it was gone. So in 5 years from now, TikTok will probably be gone. It'll be something else, and I will have to be doing that, or I will have to agree to just not write books as a full-time job. Again, I can write books as a hobby. Selling a couple thousand of them, you know, that's, I could do that, but doing it as a full-time novelist where this is the way I, you know, I pay my bills, you've got to be out there. And it was only seeing the returns I was getting from trying to push stuff on the other platforms that I realized I've got to go where the people are. And everybody said the engagement on TikTok is not a little higher. It's 1,000 times higher than anything else. It's everybody. That's where everybody has gone. And even now, I'm sure that a lot of the kids have already moved on to Snapchat or whatever. But right now it's crazy. The number of people you can reach there is crazy.
Yeah. All right. I always like to close these interviews by asking if there's anything I should have asked, if there's anything you think folks should know about your novels, about the world of social media, the world in general. What should folks know about that I have not informed them about?
Well, it is important to me that I don't write about a world that is doomed. I don't write post-apocalypses. I don't write, like, I don't want people to be scared of the future, because I grew up in the Cold War and did not believe there was going to be a future. I thought that by now, if I had somehow survived to the year, the crazy futuristic year of 2023, that at best we would be living in a nuclear wasteland, fighting rats for food and being chased around by mutants and bandits. I was told in the mid 80s that nuclear war was going to happen. It was purely a matter of when. I was told that over and over again. It was not if, it was when, that the Soviets would, and then suddenly in the early 90s, the Soviet Union just evaporates. And it's like, oh, okay, well, I guess not. So, you're going to have a future. It turns out you're going to have to figure out a career. And because I did not think I would have an adult life. So, for me to sit here in my air conditioned home doing podcasts to promote my silly books that I sat at home and wrote in my bedroom and got paid a bunch of money for, and say, oh my gosh, the world is just awful. It's all falling apart. It's like, if somebody had told me the conversations and controversies we were going to be having. If you'd gone back to 15-year-old me or 12-year-old me or 13-year-old me and told me that this is what I was going to be worried about, I'd be worried about book sales, that it's like, yes, we've got a crazy president who is frankly kind of on the same level of bad as Reagan, but people will regard that as apocalyptic. I would say, I'll take that any day of the week, that the world is still there, that poverty around the world has dropped massively, that technology is like the smartphones we have now, they didn't even have those in Star Trek. To tell me that this is where we would be, I would have said, I will take that any day of the week. So I do not have this message of be afraid of the future, because I grew up afraid of the future and it affected my personality in ways that I am still trying to undo. Because when you look out into the horizon and you just see darkness, it's hard to be ambitious about things. It's hard to care about things. It's hard to be passionate about things, because like, well, what does it matter? The reality is everybody thinks the world is going to end all the time, and it just never does. So yeah, you probably, if you are a young person out there, if you're in your 20s, there's a real good chance that in the year 2075, you're still going to have a job. You're still going to have birthday parties. You're still going to have memos and a grocery store and bills and all the stuff. We're on a trend line where the world has steadily gotten better in fits and starts, but there'll still be wars. The politicians will still be scumbags. The corporations will still be greedy, but it's, you will still have things in your life worth living for. And I would highly encourage you to stick around for it, because when I was a teenager, I over and over again thought about not doing that. And I'm glad that I am here.
The name of the new book is Zoe is Too Drunk for This Dystopia. The first book in the series is called Futuristic Violence and Fancy Suits. And the second one, Zoe Punches the Future in the Dick. Well, you know, that's how did your publisher like that title? I'm just curious.
They thought it was hilarious. That was, I submitted that as a working title on the manuscript because I thought it was funny. And then they started sending me cover mock-ups with it on there. I was like, oh, we're going with that. I'm like, yeah, why not? It stands out. And, you know, I think there was a time when that would have been considered racy, but if you go to the self-help book section, every title has the F word in it. So it's like, okay, why not? But, people think it's funny. They see it on the shelf. They get a little chuckle out of it. I figure if I can bring somebody one moment of happiness when they're passing the book cover, that if you have Kindle Unlimited, that which is the Kindle's Netflix for books, both of those books are free on there. Otherwise, you can probably get them for some very inexpensive price or steal a copy, whatever. If you want to catch up on the series, it should not cost you very much. Yeah. But I would obviously prefer you pay full price for the most expensive possible edition you can. But it these days, everything's so expensive. There's lots of inexpensive ways to catch up on the series if you want. But also, if you just want to read this one, you can. They're episodic. It will explain to you exactly what's going on in the first few pages.
Yes, very much. All right, Jason, thank you for being on the show again. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
All right, my name again is Sonny Bunch. I'm culture editor at The Bulwark, and I will be back next week with another episode of The Bulwark Goes to Hollywood. We'll see you guys then.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
You've done it again, finance teams. You closed the books, and it went fine. Sure, some expenses were missing receipts, but that's fine. Stayed late to process invoices by hand. It's all fine. But don't you deserve better than fine? With Ramp, expenses are submitted with a text, invoices are coded automatically, and everything is connected to your accounting system, so you can close the books without all the busy work. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.